Thanks for joining us this week, and welcome to Mutuality Matters, a weekly podcast hosted by CBE International, where our mission is to promote the biblical message that God calls women and men of all cultures, races, and classes to share authority equally in service and leadership in the home, church, and world. Let's get into this week's episode.
Well, welcome everyone to CBE's podcast, Mutuality Matters. Thank you for joining us as we explore Women in Words, Bible Translation, and Why It Matters to the World's Women and Men. And I'm thankful here today to have with us Dr. Roy Ciampa, a distinguished guest and someone I've known for years. And let me just introduce you to Roy if you haven't met him already or seen his work. Dr. Ciampa is the S. Lewis and Ann W. Armstrong Professor of Religion and the Chair of Religion Department at Samford University. Roy has served at the NEDA Institute for Biblical and American Bible Society, providing advanced professional development in biblical studies, Bible translation, and scripture engagement to leaders in the area of scholarship worldwide. He has also served as professor of New Testament and chaired the Division of Biblical Studies at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, where he continues to provide leadership for their doctoral of ministry track and in Bible translation. Before that, Roy was a missionary professor of biblical studies in Portugal and served as a translator for the Portuguese Bible Society's Contemporary Portuguese Translation of Scripture. Dr. Ciampa has authored numerous scholarly essays on New Testament themes, especially on the interpretation of the Old Testament within the New Testament, but also on issues more directly related to Bible translation, including articles that address translation issues in Acts 17:11 and 1 Corinthians 7:1 that became footnotes to the CSB. He is also the author of a book on the presence and function of Scripture in Galatians 1 and 2, and co-author with Brian Rossner on the Pillar Commentary on 1 Corinthians. Roy is an ordained minister and someone I have enjoyed interacting with at my alma mater, Gordon-Conwell, and also at the Evangelical Theological Society. So a warm welcome to you, Roy.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. So would you mind beginning with us today by sharing with our listeners your own experiences as a Bible translator and trainer of Bible translators? What have you enjoyed most about your work in Bible translation, and what has also been challenging for you?
Sure. So in terms of my experiences, I mean, I'll touch on some of the things you've already mentioned. It was after I had completed my PhD and while I was still a missionary in Portugal, that I was invited by the Bible Society of Portugal to join a team of scholars that would revise their contemporary Portuguese translation of the Bible. And we carried out a really thorough revision of the New Testament that essentially amounted to providing a new translation. Mm-hmm. And then we spent a few more years providing a much lighter revision of the contemporary translation of the Old Testament. That was really my first real introduction to Bible translation. It lit a fire that's been burning since then. A few years after I had joined the faculty at Gordon-Conwell, the director of the Doctor of Ministry program asked me if I'd be interested in co-mentoring a track in Bible translation, which I started doing. And then around that same time, I began collaborating with the NIDA Institute for Biblical Scholarship of the American Bible Society and attending their annual postdoctoral seminars in translation studies. And that really enriched my understanding of various approaches, theories, and issues in the broader academic area known as translation studies. So that's been an important part of my background. And then related to that, in 2014, I accepted a position as a manager of biblical scholarship and integrated training for the NIDA Institute. And that resulted in regular trips to Angola and to India every year to work with others from American Bible Society, from United Bible Societies, from National Bible Societies, and other organizations to provide workshops and seminars for their Bible translators. Hmm. It also resulted in trips to places like Brazil, Canada, El Salvador, Greece, Kenya, South Korea, many different places to be parts of teams offering workshops, conferences, seminars, and other things on Bible translation. So, I mean, since 2018, I've been here at Samford University, but I continue working in that Doctor of Ministry track. And I think getting to your question of what I've enjoyed most, you know, I've had a strong sense that when I first got into working as a trainer of Bible translators and translation consultants, that I was supposed to have all this knowledge to offer. But actually, in working with Christians around the world who are working in very different cultural contexts and very different linguistic situations, what I've really enjoyed is how much I've learned from them. Every time I have gone someplace to provide some sort of training, I learn more about the faith and the challenges that are faced by translators and all kinds of places around the world, and the sacrifices that they're making to figure out how best to translate the Bible in their context, in their languages, and then how to apply it and how to read it and use the scriptures in those contexts as well. So that's been my greatest joy. I think the greatest challenge, besides the travel schedule I had back at that time, is recognizing just, again, how under-resourced many of these translators themselves are and the great sacrifices that they make, and realizing, for instance, after somebody might spend years helping provide a translation in their own mother tongue, there may not be other opportunities for them to use the skills that they've developed. And so just that sense of finding kind of solidarity with translators around the world and then recognizing the struggles that they have, which are greater than the struggles I ever had as somebody collaborating with them.
Beautiful. You're absolutely perfectly suited for this work in, I don't know, speaking on Bible translation, but helping us to see behind the themes of culture and opportunity and resourcing. So it's a great thing for us to be in prayer about these issues you raise. Thank you. And thank you for your sacrifice and for elevating the sacrifices others have made, Roy. Can you speak also to the nature and complexity of Bible translation and how these complexities are both challenges and opportunities in producing a reliable Bible translation?
Sure. Most Bible translators around the world have been taught to strive for kind of a variety of qualities in any Bible translation. Usually the ones that are most frequently mentioned are clarity, accuracy, naturalness, and acceptability. And we could talk about those, but these are not always equally achievable, and sometimes they're in tension with each other. And translators have to wrestle with these complexities that are different in every language. The purposes for the translation can be different in a different context, whether it's meant to be used by just a common reader, or they want something more formal for public reading. There are different sponsors behind each translation, and the translators have to have some sort of understanding of a relationship between the text they're translating, their own role as translators, and how they relate to those who are sponsoring the translation. They wrestle with what we call vulnerability in translation, because every Bible translator knows that the people that they're translating the Bible for are probably already familiar with the Bible in some other language. And if their Bible translation doesn't say the same thing as somebody else's Bible translation, that becomes a problem, or becomes an issue they have to work through. I mean, there are a variety of theories. There are functionalist approaches and relevance theory-informed approaches and approaches that focus on discourse features and the receiving text. There is all kinds of work being done now on translating for deaf communities, and they have their own challenges. I mean, sign languages often will require information that we don't necessarily have in the biblical text. There's a lot of focus on oral translation today, translating for communities that don't have a history or culture of written literature, and trying to find ways where, you know, maybe the translation is going to be recorded and played instead of read. Challenges with orthography, that is, even coming up with a system of writing down letters and languages that have never been written down before. In some places, translators have been prohibited from using religious language that is thought to be owned by the dominant religion. And that can create all kinds of challenges when they're trying to translate religious terms in the Bible if they're prohibited. If every language and cultural context has its own translation challenges, things mentioned in the biblical text that don't exist in that language or in that context, or information required by the language that the biblical text just don't provide. Mm-hmm. An example that I've often heard is where the Bible will refer to somebody as someone's brother. You know, this is, you know, Peter's brother or somebody else's brother. But they'll tell us, well, we don't actually have a general word for brother. For us, our words are eldest brother or older brother or younger brother. So which one is this? Is this person is just, the biblical text just says they're a brother, but we have to identify them more specifically because where we come from, it makes a big deal whether or not this is the eldest brother or just an older brother or where this brother comes in the line. And so they have to wrestle with things like that. Mm-hmm. These and many other kinds of tensions are faced, and there are different tensions and different struggles in different places around the world, but it's always complex, but also it's fascinating. Mm. And these also do provide all kinds of, I mean, the great opportunity is in most of the cases where I'm working with, where I've worked with people, we're talking about people that have never had a Bible translation in this language before.
Yeah.
So the opportunity to work through these issues or to help the Bible translators work through these issues and then provide translation so that people can hear or read the Word of God in their own mother tongue for the first time is, there's nothing quite like that in all Christian work that I can think of.
Right, right. It's just magnificent, the layer of complexity you illustrate here. And I'm sure you arrive in these countries and have no idea what you're going to face. It's great to hear from your own experiences. I think those of us here in the West and where I sit certainly had no idea, literally no idea. So what steps then do translation teams take to produce translations that are cleared of translator bias, which I'm sure every culture faces?
Every culture does face that. And translation advisors and consultants, and in many cases, translators will try to watch for bias. But of course, it's difficult to assess one's own biases as well as those of one's colleagues. None of us ever consider that our judgments are biased. We just think we're assessing arguments and we assess them differently from each other. But it can help if a translation advisor or consultant can recognize and point out patterns. For example, how often are women who are key to a passage, how often is it that they aren't mentioned in the passage heading where we have those headings over a passage? Or how often is a passage that might be or is more likely to be, in my biased opinion, to be about husbands and wives rather than about men and women in general, and yet the translation doesn't even mention that in a footnote? Mm-hmm. Or how often are pronouns more consistently, how often do translations more consistently use masculine pronouns and more often than either the biblical text or the standard usage of the language requires? Mm-hmm. So if you can point out kind of inconsistencies or on the other hand, consistent tendencies in one direction versus another, then that can be helpful in leading other people to recognize maybe they aren't just making unbiased judgments, but there could be something else at play.
Well, that's certainly what Catherine Bushnell noted in her beautiful volume, God's Word to Women, written in the early 1900s. She saw these patterns and she said, perhaps there's just needles in a haystack, but they're all pointing in one direction, is what she said.
Yeah, that's right.
So how, Roy, can English Bible readers detect and overcome translation biases that remain in their English Bibles? What do you recommend? I mean, based on this vast experience you've had.
Well, it's a real challenge. I think the starting point is to be reading in a very diverse set of translations and to note differences that may or may not reflect biases or a tendency or even occasional adoption of tendentious exegetical conclusions. So if you only have one Bible, then and that's or one Bible translation, and you just think that's the only way to do it, you're not likely to notice much. But if you actually read broadly and compare as many different translations as you can, that will be helpful. Although where any bias has been reflected across virtually all translations, then it becomes still very difficult to recognize and deal with it. And it will take someone someday, you know, perhaps a scholar, translator, to say, hey, maybe all the translations do this, but is that really what this word or this expression is getting at? But for most, I mean, that's usually going to be dependent upon some scholar to break through. Your typical English Bible reader is usually going to be dependent. In my view, there may be better answers than what I can give, but comparing diverse Bible translations is probably a first start.
That's very helpful. All right. Would increasing the number of translators on a translation team be useful, in your opinion, including maybe more women from various theological perspectives or ethnic branches of the community?
I think that would really be helpful where everywhere possible. But in the global context, teams are sometimes quite small, and the amount of diversity can be limited by cultural and contextual issues, whether or not you can find women with the necessary educational experience or in a position to work outside the home. And there are other kinds of local challenges as well, whether or not the women would be free to travel to sites where teams gather from time to time to work in larger groups on the Bible translation. We do see more and more women involved at every level of Bible translation, from the local mother tongue translator to people that are taking up positions in Bible translation agencies or national Bible societies. And sometimes they're heading the National Bible Society or heading the translation work. And so we are seeing more and more gender diversity and some other kinds of diversity. Of course, having that diversity in a team isn't a guarantee that biases will be overcome. We all know of women who have very patriarchal views of women. But as a rule, the more gender, ethnic, and geographical diversity there is on a team, the more likely it is that someone will ask a question or make an observation that might otherwise not have been asked, or an observation that wouldn't have been made, and that will improve the translation. In cases where creating diverse teams is impossible or where there's limited potential diversity, it would certainly be the case that making sure the translators are familiar with a broad range of interpretive voices and wider questions and observations that have been made by interpreters with diverse experiences would be important. But the simple answer is yes, it would be helpful. The more complex answer is there are challenges in many places.
Right. And I think you've mentioned some of the English translations that we see coming back to a Western context where the teams were not very diverse and they had a specific agenda. And I don't know if you care to speak about those problems.
Sure. I think, again, more and more, I mean, I remember when the NIV first came out, the New International Version, there was a big emphasis, I guess I'm dating myself too, aren't I? But there was a big emphasis on how international it was. And I'd have to go back and remind myself, I didn't in preparing for this, how many of the translators on the original NIV were not only international, but of different genders, mm-hmm. and different ethnicities, or how many of them were from kind of your Western kinds of nations around the world. But now if you look at the NIV Translation Committee, you do see clearly a focus on a greater diversity within that team. Right. If you look back at the ESV version, I haven't checked out, you know, who lately is involved in any potential future revisions of the ESV. But you can go and review. I often have shown, for various reasons, a video of the ESV team meeting at Tyndale House. And as the video goes around and you see the debates going on, everyone participating looks kind of like me, mm-hmm. In some of the most basic ways. And they're fine scholars, and some of them are good friends of mine. But the very fact that they all are kind of white, Anglo-centric men suggests that there may be some voices or points of view that aren't, clearly there are voices and points of view that aren't going to be heard there, even if they're trying to pay attention to what women and other people are saying in the scholarship.
Right. Yeah, thank you very much. Well, this was quite an airplane ride over some important issues. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back as soon as possible to hear some more from Roy's vast experience. So please do stay tuned.
CBE International presents Women in Scripture and Mission. Threatened by the growing Hebrew population in Egypt, Pharaoh ordered the midwives Shifra and Pua to kill all newborn Hebrew boys. Instead, Shifra and Pua risked their lives and disobeyed. When Pharaoh questioned them, they used Pharaoh's ethnic prejudice to blind him to their life-saving obedience. Shifra and Pua are the first documented individuals to engage in peaceful civil disobedience against unjust government edicts. Learn more at radiowomen.org.
So here we go. We're welcoming you back and to our fascinating conversation with Dr. Roy Ciampa. So Roy, now as we conclude the second part, or we begin the second part of our first session with you and welcoming you back next month, can you please address what you consider to be some of the most or the most successful Bible translations available today? What added to their success and maybe some of their weaknesses?
Thank you. And of course, to answer your question, the question depends on the definition of successful. Mm-hmm. So the most typical way of defining success, I suppose, would be by the numbers of people that are using it and adopting it. And so if we were to use that definition, then we'd have to say the King James Version has been in English highly successful. And then the NIV, the ESV has been successful along that parameter, the New Revised Standard Version. And then if you go around the world, you can look in Portugal to the Almeida Bible, and you can look in Spain and France and Spanish and French speaking countries have their own kind of, if you will, their version of the King James Version, which gets updated as well as contemporary translations. However, I tell my students that just as important as reading a Bible is learning to read it well or in a healthy way. I often mention in my classes here, so I'm here at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And so near the beginning of my general class on the Bible, I'll point out that there are a few places perhaps better than Birmingham, Alabama, for being reminded that at least as important as whether or not someone's reading their Bible is the question of how they're reading their Bible. Since you can look here and remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail and the whole civil rights movement, and be reminded that you had lots of people that were reading the Bible, but reading in a way that justified not only originally slavery, but Jim Crow and ongoing racial prejudice. So even excellent Bible translations have been interpreted in ways that are harmful. And in my view, it isn't actually possible to translate the Bible in a way that eliminates such harmful potential and guarantees only the positive transformation for which it's intended, and which all involved in the process of Bible translation hope that it will be used. I'm reminded that even the Greek texts of the New Testament were interpreted in heretical ways that had to be ruled out by church councils. And if we look at the reading of Greek texts by the Greek fathers, and many who are reading Greek for many years, they were reading the New Testament in ways that were harmful to women. So there are things that we can do to improve Bible translations today and to make sure that they are to try and do our best to make sure there's as little bias found in them as possible. But ultimately, I think a lot of this is going to be about teaching people how to read the Bible in ways that are helpful and healthy and not harmful.
That's excellent. Right. And thank you for bringing up those important issues, which are very dear to CBE. Roy, when looking at sort of your favorite Bible translations of all time, can you talk about what personally energizes you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't help but think about of the innumerable national translators around the globe, of mother tongue translators who are working under challenging conditions with minimal resources, who often carry out their translation work on top of pastoral responsibilities or farming and other responsibilities. Oftentimes, they can focus, you know, only on their translation after the harvest is done and the time between the harvesting is done and the planting is done. When I worked with Bible translators in the far northeastern corner of India, it took some of them just as long as to travel to our meeting place within India from their village in the foothills of the Himalayas as it took me to get there flying, you know, international jets from the United States. And I continued to be, and many of them were often working in villages without paved roads with very rare and poor internet service, that they had to, you know, find special ways of connecting with others. So I continue to be in awe of the faith and undaunting service of so many of these unknown translators around the globe. I'm also reminded, of course, of those who've been martyred or otherwise suffered for their involvement in Bible translation. You could just Google the words Bible translation and martyrs together to read not just about William Tyndale, who was burnt at the stake in 1536, but numerous others as well. So those are the ones. It's the unknown, unnamed Bible translators who are working away faithfully under these kinds of circumstances that really would be my favorites. They're the ones that inspire me.
Right. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The invisible heroes of our faith, making it possible for one generation to the next to know Christ, love him, and serve him well. Yes, that's so very true. And so very true in many fields of Christian faith. Thank you for pointing that out. And may we keep them in our prayers. Mm-hmm. Can you share some about the translation teams you've worked with, along with their translation priorities? You've mentioned some, but perhaps there are others you'd like to, other people or topics you'd like to address.
Sure. The teams that I've worked with or worked on or with, you know, there's of course the team that I was working with in Portugal and that contemporary Portuguese translation of the Bible. And that experience was probably more like what listeners are familiar with from English Bible translations. We had a number of scholars, people with PhDs working on it, who had, you know, lots of resources and all kinds of kind of knowledge of languages and biblical backgrounds and that sort of thing. And in that translation, the priority was actually to provide what would be called a common reader translation. They had the Almeida Bible translation, which is kind of the Portuguese equivalent of the King James Version. People love it, people read it, but like the King James, many times they struggle to understand what it's saying. It's very archaic. And this translation we were working on was a translation where someone who was, you know, had maybe a high school, maybe even a middle school knowledge of contemporary Portuguese could read it and understand what it's saying. And it's the kind of translation where people would say, oh, you know, that's what that passage meant. You know, I've read it so many times in the Almeida, but it just went over my head. And now I understand what the text is saying. But in my work with American Bible Society, I mainly worked, I mean, I was sent to many different places to give one-off workshops or seminars or speak at a conference in lots of different countries. But most of my time was spent in that part of northeastern India or in Angola. And in India, I mean, there were like 20 different translators from various people groups in the northeastern region that would come to the workshops, which were typically once or twice a year. And those people would be working on languages from around the region that none of our listeners, well, maybe we have some from that area that would be listening in, but people in America would usually not know these language, you know, Nagamese and there's a whole bunch of them. And they would all add up to, you know, millions of speakers altogether. Mm-hmm. But many of those translators were working on again, translate. Some of them would be working on more of what we would think of as a formal equivalent translation, and some would be working on translations that were just more what we might call common reader translations. It depends on what translations are already available in any given language. In Angola, we were working with 21 translators from seven teams. Oh, I should go back. Those translators I was speaking about in India, typically it was one translator per language. And so they were the team. So when you talk about diversity, there could be diversity in terms of the leadership over those translators, you know, the consultants and other people involved in the project. But the translation was being carried out by a single translator per language, whereas in Angola, we were working with 21 different translators who were working on seven projects, seven teams. So you had basically three translators per project, which of course is still very small compared to what we're used to in English or European Bible translations. But again, there in Angola, they would already have access to Portuguese translations, and they were working in languages like Kikongo and Ubuntu and some Bantu and other languages in that region. A total of almost 5 million speakers of the languages that we'd be talking about that most Americans would not be familiar with. And they'd be, again, working with different goals depending on the languages and depending on what translations were already known by the people in those contexts. But typically, more often than not, they're working on a translation that can be fairly easily comprehended by a majority of readers in that area. By the way, it reminds me something I didn't mention earlier in terms of a complication. Early on in our conversation, we were talking about those, and I was just reminded that when we were working on our Portuguese translation, we had to wrestle with the fact that Portuguese isn't spoken and used in precisely the same way everywhere in Portugal. There's the way it's spoken and written in Lisbon and most of the country, but there are some kind of linguistic differences you'd find in the far north of the country, especially the northeast of the country. And so, and you wrestle with this in other languages as well, where you'd have to decide which version of this language or which variant are you going to emphasize? Are you going to try and find a way, as what we did in Portugal, was find a way that it, most of it was written according to the standards you'd find in Lisbon and most of the country. But there were a few linguistic issues where we kind of gave a nod of the head towards the way that the language was spoken in the north and northeastern part of the country, so that people all over the country could read it and nobody would think it sounded strange, but it wasn't going to be exactly the form that you found in any particular area. And these are some of the things that are faced by some of these other translators as well. Now, translations are commissioned by different people. There are national Bible societies that commission translations for the languages within their country. There are also other Bible translation agencies. Those who are commissioned by national Bible societies are usually focused on meeting the needs of Christians in churches who don't have the Bible in their own language. Some Bible translation agencies have historically focused on providing Bible translations for communities that don't have any or any significant number of Christians or churches, with the hope that the scriptures will help with the task of evangelization and initial church planting. When I was working with American Bible Society, my role was primarily to help put together and work with teams of 5 to 6 colleagues from American Bible Society, United Bible Societies, National Bible Societies, and other translation agencies to go put on workshops for the translators, covering things like translation theories and practice, understanding various literary genres. We might have sessions on understanding Hebrew poetry or biblical narratives or other literary genre. And then the challenges or opportunities of translating these different literary genre into various languages. Or we'd spend time talking, or we'd also spend time talking about cultural backgrounds or textual criticism and its relevance for Bible translation and more. And in our work of translation training, it was also always training on the software that most Bible translators use around the world. It's paratext training, and so there's always time dedicated to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is just fascinating and segues beautifully into the next question, which, you know, given the complexities of the teams, the people on the teams, the goal of the teams, where in this process have you seen a concern to prevent bias regarding women?
I think go ahead.
And how is it dealt with, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the most common way, frankly, is seen in the attempt to address this issue by including as many women as possible in the translation process at as many stages as possible. Now, again, when you have these small teams, you know, if there's one person translating for the language, these aren't all going to be women. And typically most of them are going to be men. If you have teams of three, then you'd be doing well if you could get one of the three to be a woman. But then you might also find that you'd have women involved as translation consultants, as translation advisors, as heads of translation work, and elsewhere, either in the National Bible Society translation work or in the International Bible Agency translation work. But that tends to be the most common way, is to make sure we get enough women in the process at many different stages and roles as possible to make sure that their voices and perspectives are being heard, including ways in which they can perceive bias that would have a negative, in fact, impact on women.
Right. Okay. Very helpful. Well, we have one last question here before we wrap up this session, and that is, Roy, can you share a few of the less complicated Bible translation recommendations you might propose on the theme of women, the bias against women in Bible translation?
Yeah, I think besides what we've already mentioned, and we'll talk about this more, I think, next time, when some of the issues that will be raised in our next session. But I tend to think that the inclusion of more paratextual information explaining the background and significance of many of the passages that have impacted women or that could more positively impact women should be a priority. That is, a number of the challenges that we face are challenges that can't in one sense be translated away. There are words that need to be translated, but we could have sidebars, footnotes, glossaries, and other things that accompany the translation itself that would provide kind of more information about, you know, what was the nature of the husband-wife relationship, what was the nature, you know, what was going on culturally that could help us understand why this language or how these relationships functioned within that society. And many times I think that there's actually a key here is to understand difference, the difference between the world of the Bible and the world in which we're reading and using the Bible today. So I think that would be something, again, we'll talk more about that. And then again, continuing to increase the number and roles of women in the translation work would help not only in helping teams pay closer attention to these issues, but also helping the teams understand how the translation or interpretation of these passages impacts the lived experience of their mothers, sisters, daughters, and other women today, so that they're not just thinking about this in some sort of a distant, cold way, but they actually have the real life experience and awareness of how these things can impact women as something that's in front of their eyes and ears as they're actually carrying out the work. And this could lead to a greater prioritization of this issue.
Yeah, very important. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts as we interview you next time. And I want to thank you, Dr. Ciampa, for so many insights, for a real thorough and brilliant background insight into Bible translation around the world. So listeners, Dr. Ciampa will be back next month to address specific issues related to women in the biblical text, and we hope you will join us in March. God bless and thank you.